All right, Daniel chapter 3. Before we get in the chapter, there are some things. That door didn't close all the way. Could we? Somebody just... You know what? The thing, the little door thing flips or something. Sean will figure it out. Sean can fix anything. Except for what? Oh, except for Frank's house? Before we get into the chapter, I want to kind of... There's some things that we covered last week that actually fit into understanding particularly chapter 3. In chapter 1, we talked about how Daniel was part of these captives from Judah, taken from Judah, the first wave of captives taken from Judah by Nebuchadnezzar, transported to Babylon, where they were trained in all the wisdom and the language and society and culture and magic and all kinds of weird stuff, everything Babylonian. And the goal is to take these kids, the best of the best, the cream of the crop from all around the world, and make these kids the center of the Babylonian government, make them help Nebuchadnezzar rule the world. And so Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are a part of that group. They are part of that group of world leaders. That's something to keep in mind before we get into this chapter. The second thing to keep in mind comes from Daniel chapter 2. Do you remember how in Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar had that freaky, weird dream? That's the one where he has this dream of this huge image or huge statue that's made up of different things. Remember the head of gold and the chest and arms of silver and the belly and the thighs of bronze and all that kind of stuff. And there's all the prophetic aspect of all that and everything. But just keep in mind that Nebuchadnezzar's had this dream about a huge statue. And in particular, as Daniel is interpreting the statue, something to keep in mind from Daniel 2:37, Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, he said, "You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold." Got it? So that's enough for the review. Let's start chapter 3, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, just a coincidence, makes an image of gold whose height is 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. That's 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide. So he makes a statue, whether it's a statue of a human or a picture of a human or, you know, a shape of a human. Some have suggested that it's, you know, maybe it's a 60-foot tall pedestal with a 30-foot tall statue on top. Could be something like that. Some have suggested maybe it was patterned after the obelisks of Egypt, where they would record lines and lines of history. Maybe this is a record of all of his exploits. But we're not told exactly what it is, except it's an image, it's a statue, it's huge, and it's made out of gold, or at least covered with gold. Probably not solid gold, because it would fall over. It wouldn't be able to stay upright. So, where do you think he gets this idea of making a big statue and making it of gold? I think he gets it from his dream. I think the dream went to his head. And, he's told some cool things about himself and about his kingdom with this dream. But he just goes and expands the whole thing and to decide, if I'm a king of kings, well, let's go for it. I'll make a big statue too, just like my dream. But this one's going to be all of gold. I'm going to be king. And I don't know if he's saying that I'm going to be king forever or something like that with this. So he makes this thing. Archaeologists have found a huge brick square, a plaza in Iraq, 6 miles southeast of the city of Babylon. And some have suggested that may be this area, this where he sets this thing up, because it says in verse 1, he set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. It's a big meeting area, big plain area that he sets this up. Verse 2, and King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So he brings in the leaders of the world, of his global empire. All of the various levels of leadership, all the leaders are brought in. So who do you think is invited among this group? Probably these kids who have been raised and are being put in charge of things. In fact, there's somebody else that may be here that I stumbled across today. I thought this was interesting. In Jeremiah 51:59, strange verse. We skipped right by this when we were doing Jeremiah. It says, the word which Jeremiah the prophet commanded Sariah, the son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, when he went with Zedekiah, the king of Judah, to Babylon in the fourth year of his reign. And Sariah was the quartermaster. In other words, there's just this little snippet that we don't have anywhere else in Scripture that records that King Zedekiah, he was the last king of Judah. In his fourth year, he reigned for 11 years. So this is 7 years before the fall of Jerusalem. In Zedekiah's fourth year, Zedekiah made a trip to Babylon. For what? We aren't told. And some have suggested, and I think this would be fascinating, to think that Zedekiah is one of these. He would qualify as a satrap, as a governor over a province. Some have suggested that of this multitude of people that are gathered from around the world for this event, some have suggested that maybe even King Zedekiah of the nation of Judah could be in this crowd. Interesting. Verse 3. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages. Because see, these leaders represent all the peoples of the world. That at the time, verse 5, that you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. So they're going to have a worship time. They're going to have a little bit of worship. They've got a worship band set up, you know, and they've been practicing and everything. And this guy gets up and announces that when the music starts, when the band plays, everybody's supposed to, at one point, fall down and start bowing before this statue of this image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Now, there could be religious significance to this, either in worshiping Nebuchadnezzar himself, or as we'll see later on in this chapter, maybe the idea that they're accepting the gods of Nebuchadnezzar. But there's probably political significance as well. The idea of swearing allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar of the world. You know, something like that. Verse 6, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There's a little incentive to do this. Okay, you don't get rewards for bowing down, but you get a little smack if you don't. You get to work on your tan. Verse 7, so at that time when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, harp, lyre, in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worship the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Hey, it worked, kind of. Something to keep in mind, gang. You can't force people to love you. I mean, you can try, but it ain't going to be real. Now, what they're doing here, this is they twist their arms, you know, and honey, you're going to love me, you know, or else, you know. It doesn't work that way. Can't force people to love you. Verse 8, therefore at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. Chaldeans, these are native Babylonians. And they make an accusation. They spoke and they said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. you, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Now, I think this is interesting. If with this notion that if King Zedekiah was present, how come he's not added to this list? I don't know. Maybe he wasn't there, but on the other hand, maybe he was bowing down. I mean, he was not a good guy, Zedekiah. Anyway, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not bowing. Verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He's got a temper here. Rage and fury. So they brought these men before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my God or worship the gold image which I have set up?" Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hand? Maybe he's given them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe you just didn't quite get it, you know. Let's just remind you here. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." Incredible guys. People like this, how can you stop them? What can you do to stop people like this? People with a faith like this. People, when they're faced with the most difficult trials, the worst kinds of threats, persecution, or whatever, and they keep going. They will not compromise. How can you stop people like this? How can we have this kind of faith? There's kind of two things about their faith that I think that are important. One is that their faith, you might call it an overcoming faith. Their faith is a faith that knows God's abilities. They said, "Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us." When you're facing difficult times, one of the important things that helps is to know, can God get you out of this? Is God able to? Is he big enough? Is he strong enough? Jeremiah 32:17 says this, "Ah, Lord God, behold, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. There is nothing too hard for you." God can do anything. He can do anything. And so part of facing tough times, gang, is asking yourself, who is your God? What can he do? Is he able? Is anybody here going through tough times? You know? There we go. We all are in some sense or other, probably. We may not be thinking about it right now, but we walk out that door and sometimes it'll hit us flat in the face. Is God able to? That's just part of it. That's a part of the formula. Is God able to? If he wants to get me out of this fire, can he do it? Is it that big of a deal for him? Is there anything too hard for him? Second thing about their kind of faith is that they had a faith that was willing to trust God's decisions. They had a faith that was willing to trust God's decisions. They said, "We know that God is able, but if not, we're still not going to bow to your God. We're still going to worship our God." Why? Because they trusted that God knew what he was going to be doing. our God is able to get us out of this mess. But even if He doesn't, we're not going to bow before you. I think of Paul in Acts 20, verse 24, when he's being told left and right about all the difficult things that he's going to face when he gets to Jerusalem. And he's been on this journey back to Jerusalem. And everywhere he goes, all the prophets come up and go, "Oh, God gave me a word for you, brother. It's going to be tough when you go back to Jerusalem. They're going to go out and they're going to go get you, you know, in Jerusalem." And Paul says to the elders of Ephesus, he says, "Look, none of these things move me. I don't count my life dear to me. But I'm going to finish the course. I'm going to keep doing this. I'm going to keep serving God." It's not just knowing what God can do, but it's learning to step back and let God do what He wants and acknowledge that it is right. Real faith, I think, is learning to trust God no matter what the outcome is, like Job. That's what Job did. He said in Job 13:15, "Though He slay me, yet will I trust Him." It's a hard thing, isn't it? And sometimes I've struggled being a pastor because people come up to me and they will tell me problems and they want me to pray for them. And I remember early in the ministry really struggling with, you know, so do I say something? Do I just pray? Or, you know, I want to say, "God has told me it's going to be okay," you know. And I know that's a real temptation for a pastor to want to, not because God has told you to, but just because you want to do something to make a person feel better, you know, and say, "Well, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay." But what if it's not? What if God decides, "I want them to go through the fire, not take them out of it"? See, the kind of faith that God wants you and I to have is a faith that says, "I'm going to trust Him even if He doesn't take me out." That God is able to. Now, see, that's not saying that I quit and that God can't do it. No, God can do it, but I'm going to trust Him regardless, whatever He says. You know, the folks in Channel 40 want to teach you that, you know, you can twist God's arm and you can make God do whatever you want, you know, and that if God doesn't do what you're asking, well, then you got a problem, you know. No, I'm sorry. God's a whole lot bigger than you and me. And God is not obligated to do what you tell Him to do. God will do what He wants to do and what is His will to do. And the question is, are you going to be smart enough to learn? Am I going to be smart enough to learn to stop, to understand that my way is not always the best way? And that sometimes God wants to go a different direction. Maybe I don't see it. Maybe I don't understand why. Maybe I think, well, the answer is I this problem has got to just disappear, and then God, You will get all kinds of glory. You know, gang, I think I'm starting to learn, especially watching some of you and the tough things that you go through, and seeing how God takes you through it. You know, sometimes the answer is not to remove the problem. Sometimes the answer is to help you through the problem so that everybody else will watch and go, "Wow, how does He keep going? How does He do it?" God knows what's best. And at some point, we have to trust that He knows what He's doing. Maybe you've read this. Some of you probably sent this to me. I get this kind of stuff sent to me all the time. Here's something I've gotten an email. Two traveling angels stopped to spend the night in the home of a wealthy family. The family was rude, and they refused to let the angels stay in the mansion's guest room. Instead, the angels were given a small space in the cold basement. As they made their bed on the hard floor, the older angel saw a hole in the wall and repaired it. When the younger angel asked why, the older angel replied, "Well, things aren't always what they seem. Things aren't always what they seem." The next night, the pair came to rest at the house of a very poor but very hospitable farmer and his wife. After sharing what little food they had, the couple let the angels sleep in their bed where they could have had a good night's rest. When the sun came up the next morning, the angels found that the farmer and his wife were in tears. their only cow, whose milk had been their sole income, lay dead in the field. The younger angel was infuriated and asked the older angel, "How could you have let this happen? The man had everything, yet you helped him," he accused. "The second family had little but was willing to share everything, and you let the cow die." "Things aren't always what they seem," the older angel replied. "When we stayed in the basement of the mansion, I noticed there was gold stored in that hole in the wall. Since the owner was so obsessed with greed and unwilling to share his fortune, I sealed the wall so he wouldn't find it. Then last night, as we slept in the farmer's bed, the angel of death came for his wife. I gave him the cow instead." Things aren't always what they seem. And, you know, maybe that's just a story. But gang, there's a lot of truth to that. Because you and I don't always see the end of things. We don't always see. Faith is learning to trust in someone or something you don't see. And faith is what God wants from us. Faith is what pleases Him. And so, gang, there's going to be times I don't get it. There's going to be times I don't see. But I can trust Him. Why can I trust Him? Because He loves me. And no one else has my best interests in heart like He does. I can trust Him. And so here's these kids, young men, and they will not bow. Why? Because their God is able to deliver them. And even if He doesn't, it doesn't make a difference. We're going to still trust God. Let's go on, verse 19. Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression of his face changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Now, the furnace, we think, is probably the kind of a deal where there's a big, tall chimney, and that's where they actually would put things in, is from the chimney, drop them down into the fire. But there would be an access doorway or a panel or something in the side of it to take stuff out, you know, at the end. And so the idea is probably that these guys are being taken to a ledge and dropped into the chimney. But Nebuchadnezzar is standing at the doorway, and he can watch what's going on inside. So that's kind of the idea here. Now, it makes a point of saying that these guys are fully clothed. Why does it make a point of that? Well, you'll see in a second. We'll see when we get on further on. Verse 22. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So you can't say, well, these guys are going to survive the fire because it just was, you know, a couple of glowing embers or something, and it wasn't all that hot in there. No, the thing is so hot that the guys that are throwing them in, they die. They're not even being put into the furnace. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound, into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So they fall into this thing. They're all tied up and everything. They got their fully clothed and everything. They fall in. Verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." Verse 25, "Look," he answered, "I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the 4th is like the Son of God." Now, he's a pagan. He doesn't understand about Jesus. He's not saying, "Isn't Jesus Christ? Hallelujah." No, he's a pagan guy. But he knows that there's something supernatural about this. And I like the fact that, I know King James and New King James say, "like the Son of God." I like that. I like that. Because who do you think the 4th person is? I got my ideas. Do you have an idea who the 4th person is? Who numero 4 is in the fire with them? I think it's Jesus. I think this is one of those incidences where Jesus showed up before he was born. This is a pre-incarnate theophany. Jesus has shown up in a special way and has rescued these guys, I think. Isaiah 43, verse 2 is a wonderful verse. And some of you may want to write that down and look at that, because this could be something that, this could be a promise that God may give you one day. Isaiah 43, 2 says this: "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, nor shall the flames scorch you." Marvelous promise. Marvelous promise that God gives to His people. Who's in the fire? I think it's Jesus is in the fire with them. And gang, you know, when we're going through our darkest times, our most difficult times, you may feel like you're all alone, but I really don't think you are. I really don't think you are. I think there's somebody in the fire with you. He doesn't abandon you. He has not forsaken you. He's most likely in the fire with you. I love the verse in Isaiah where God says that He dwells in a high and lofty place and with the lowly and the brokenhearted. That's our God. He is, you know, what's one of the names of Jesus that we talk about during Christmas time? Emmanuel, God with us. He's in the fire with you. Verse 26. Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God." He's got it. You think he's got a clue? He's getting it, at least. He says, "Come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. They didn't even smell like fire. You know, have you ever gone down to the beach for a beach barbecue, you know, at night, you know, and roast marshmallows or something, you know, and get a bunch of buddies around one of the fire pits, you know? Are you with me here? You ever do that? What do you smell like when you come home at night? It smells like smoke. I mean, you know, my sweatshirt's always, you know, it's like, I could still smell this thing. And I wasn't even in the fire. These guys have been in the fire, and God has completely protected them. There was something that was burned up in the fire, though. You know what it was? Can you tell what it was? The ropes. They were thrown in bound, but once they were in there, they were walking around. In other words, something happened to the ropes. There's kind of a picture here of how God refines us, isn't there? We go through the fire, and the things that get burnt in the fire sometimes are the things that bind us, the things that have been polluting our lives, the things that have been holding us captive. Gang, that's one of God's ways of blessing you, is by putting you in. I can't believe he's going to say this. Yeah, I'm going to say it. I think one of the ways God blesses us, beloved, is by putting us in the fire and taking us through it. So the ropes burn. Verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no God, no other God who can deliver like this." He's just kind of an extreme guy, you know. He just goes to extremes. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. What an awesome thing, how God delivered them. What a wonderful thing. Now, there is a picture here that some have suggested, and I think it's worth thinking about. Not that you want to build any doctrine on it or anything. This doesn't prove anything doctrinally, but I think it's kind of interesting to think of this as a picture. Some have suggested, and I agree, I think this is kind of a picture of what's going to happen in the days of the tribulation on the earth. Because in the days of the tribulation will be the worst times this world has ever gone through, just like Nebuchadnezzar heating the furnace 7 times hotter. In the days of the tribulation, there will be a Gentile ruler who will demand to be worshipped. He will demand to be worshipped as God. And we call that fellow the Antichrist. And we believe that there will also be, the scriptures seem to indicate, that there will be some Jews who will not do it. And they will have the wrath of the Antichrist poured out against them. And God will supernaturally protect them. And so I think that's kind of a cool thing. I think this could be a picture of things to come. One of these things where this was a real deal, this was absolutely a real historical, factual deal that happened, and yet it also seems to portray some things in the future. Now, some have asked the question, well, what about Daniel? Where was Daniel? Some people even go as far as saying, well, Daniel maybe is a picture of the Gentile church, because where is he? He isn't there. That's kind of an interesting idea. Could be. The only thing is Daniel is Jewish, so I don't know if I want to quite go there. And where was Daniel, by the way? We aren't told. We don't know where he was. Maybe he was away on business or something. Or maybe he just got an exemption because he was so high in the government or something. Who knows? Daniel chapter 4. Chapter 4. Now, this is kind of a cool thing because we get to hear a little bit from Nebuchadnezzar himself. It is thought that this chapter takes place towards the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. He would reign for 43 years, conquer so much of the world, build huge buildings and cities and palaces. And one of the 7 wonders of the world was called the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. And awesome stuff he did. And we think that this might have taken place somewhere towards the latter part of his reign. Nebuchadnezzar, verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in the earth, peace be multiplied to you. Now see, apparently he's written some stuff and he's handed it to his buddy Daniel, and Daniel included it in his book. Verse 2, I, Nebuchadnezzar, thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are His signs, and how mighty His wonders! His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and His dominion is from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? The guy's always, he's a dreamer, I guess, huh? And has another one of those nightmares. Verse 6. Therefore, I issued a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that I might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream, but they did not make known to me its interpretation. Now, remember in chapter 2, he didn't tell them the dream. He wanted them to tell him the dream. And that was part of his thing. He wanted to find out how much these guys really knew. Well, this time he's not worried about it. He just wants to know what the dream means. So he tells the guys the dream, and they act as if they don't have a clue. And it could be, maybe they don't have a clue. I kind of am not sure about that. I'm kind of curious about it personally. Verse 8, but at last Daniel came before me. His name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. In him is this. Remember, that he renamed everybody back in chapter 1. So all the Jewish boys got Babylonian names. This was Daniel's Babylonian name. It says, in him is the spirit of the holy God. Now, again, does Nebuchadnezzar know about the Holy Spirit? Probably not. But he sees that something's different. And that somehow God has put his spirit in this guy. Something's different about Daniel. It says, and I told the dream before him, saying, Belteshazzar,
chief of the magicians, because I know that the Spirit of the Holy God is in you and no secret troubles you, explain to me the visions of my dream that I have seen and its interpretation. These were the visions of my head while on my bed. I was looking, and behold. So here we go. Here's the dream. A tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen to the ends of all the earth. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it. The birds of the heaven dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven. And then we're going to talk about what the watcher says. The watcher, this is an angel. A watcher. He's describing an angelic being. An angel who's watching. He calls him a watcher. Some of the translations say messenger. I like the idea of watcher. The angels are watching. You are being observed. Right now, on the closed-circuit cameras of heaven, you are being... Who needs this closed-circuit camera? Actual, specific, angelic beings are watching you and me. This is not meant to freak you out. It's not meant to make you paranoid. But it ought to do something to us. Have you ever walked into a room and somebody's in there and suddenly they cover everything up? They hide things, you know. They change channels on the TV. Have you ever done that kind of thing? You know, when you're thinking, oh boy, what were you doing? You know, right? Why? Because sometimes we do things. I do things. Sometimes I do things when I think that I'm alone and nobody's watching. And then somebody walks in the room and I'm thinking, I should not be doing this, should I? You ever do that? You probably never do that. One of the biggest lies that Satan can tell us is the lie that nobody can see you. Nobody sees me. One of the biggest lies. Because tell you the truth, gang, if we had a clue of how many people are watching, I think a whole lot would change. A whole lot would change. Isaiah 29:15 says, woe to them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord, and their works are in the dark, and they say, who seeth us, and who knoweth us? God sees. That alone should be enough, right? That alone should be enough to just like sober us up. If we really had it, and you know what? He doesn't take his eyes off of you. Now, how does he watch everybody at the same time? I don't have a clue. It's because he's a whole lot bigger than you and I. And so that's okay. God can see us. But gang, the angels can see us too. That's kind of scary. And so Nebuchadnezzar is talking about the story. He says, and I saw in the visions of my head while in my bed, and there was a watcher. Somebody's standing out there watching this thing. You know, I'm watching this tree, you know, and then there's this guy that's up there and he's watching, you know, and it says, a holy one coming down from heaven. And he cried aloud and said thus, chop down the tree and cut off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts get out from under it and the birds from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze. In the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. I think it's interesting. It says, let him graze. Let the tree, let him graze. A tree grazing? But it says him. Let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man. Let him be given the heart of a beast. and let seven times pass over him. This decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. Now, this is interesting. I don't know if you catch it, but the angels insinuating that Nebuchadnezzar, king of all kings, global world ruler, is the lowest of all men. That's kind of the insinuation. Did you catch that? Now, it seems like the whole point of this, the angel says, the whole point of this is for this thing, this person, to understand who is in charge. Who's running things? God is running things. It's a key to understanding humility. It's who is in charge? Who is in charge? Am I in charge? Or is God in charge? Verse 18, this dream, I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, declare its interpretation, since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. Verse 19. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time. I think one of the translations says for an hour. He just like, so he's going, I'm not sure. Well, maybe is not the great word. He's just like, freezes. And his thoughts troubled him. I think it's because he gets it. So the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you and its interpretation concern your enemies. In other words, this is bad news, buddy. And I just wish this was for somebody else other than you. Now, I don't know you. I don't know about you. Maybe it's because I just read the story so much. I know how it's all going to turn out. You know, I know what it's all about. But to me, it just does not sound that difficult to figure this one out. Does it seem all that difficult to you to figure this out? This tree grows up, which is actually a man, because we're told that at the end, because it's talking about the heart of a man and the heart of an animal, all this kind of stuff. You know, so it's talking about a guy who's so big that the whole world depends on him. Who is that? Huh? Who is that? It doesn't sound like it's that difficult of a dream to interpret. But I think the problem is, we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar who throws people into burning fiery furnaces and cuts them in pieces and destroys their houses. And who wants to give Nebuchadnezzar bad news? Right? Right? I wouldn't want to give Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, even godly King David, boy, you don't want to give him bad news. Some of his guys were afraid to send somebody out to give him bad news because he sometimes killed people who gave him bad news. You know, that's what kings do. So I guess I kind of wonder, you know, all these wise guys, and they can't figure this out? I mean, okay. I'm just wondering if there's something more, like they're just a little bit scaredy cats to be truthful here. The tree that you saw, Daniel says, the tree that you saw which grew and became strong, whose height reached to the heavens, which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely and its fruit abundant, in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and whose branches the birds of the heaven have their home, it is you, O King, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the end of the earth. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, and the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, let him graze with the beast of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O King, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my Lord the King. They shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven. Probably talking about the watchers, the they. And seven times shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men,
and gives it to whomever he chooses. Notice he doesn't say, he doesn't repeat the makes the basest of men rule over it. He doesn't repeat that one. I thought that was kind of funny. And inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. Daniel not only has the understanding of the dream, but he has the courage to speak out. Ephesians 4:15 talks about speaking the truth in love. We grow up in all aspects unto him. It's an important principle, gang, of growing in the Lord. Speaking the truth in love. That's one of the ways that we grow. Somebody has to tell me that my certain bad habits are annoying them, because I may not get it by myself. We need to speak the truth, but to do it in love. And you know what? As you read through the rest of this chapter, I get the feeling that Daniel loves Nebuchadnezzar. I don't question that. Daniel loves his king. Even he says, oh, I wish this was happening to somebody else. Daniel loves the man. And he loves him enough to speak the truth. To speak the truth. Proverbs says, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Sometimes, gang, sometimes we know the answer, but we don't say it. And I'm not sure that's the loving thing to do. Sometimes. Daniel also sees this dream as a warning, not just as something that's inevitable. You see that? Because at the end he says, well, what we just read, he says, and so, pal, would you shape up, clean up your life? And maybe this we can put this off a little bit. When Jonah was sent to Nineveh, do you remember what his message was? His message was, 40 days and judgment comes! You'll get rid of you suckers, you know, I just hate you Ninevites, you know. Yeah, we didn't quite say that, but it's close. He hated the people of Nineveh, hated the Assyrians. All he said was, 40 days and comes judgment. And you know what? The people took it seriously and they repented. They changed. They turned around, and God pulled back the judgment. Sometimes prophecies are not talking about the inevitable. Sometimes they're meant as warnings. And so Daniel sees that, and he says, pal, would you just shape up? Maybe we can put this off for a bit. So, verse 28. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months... At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon, and the king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built, for a royal dwelling and by my mighty power, and for the honor of my majesty? Our night is wonderful. Oh, look what I've done.
Whether he's walking along the hanging gardens or whatever, he's just awfully impressed with himself. And while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. This is the watchers. They're watching. They're waiting. They're seeing when he will cross the line. A voice fell from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen. Seven times shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. That very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers. and his nails like bird's claws. Boy, talk about humiliating. King of kings! Out in the field, you know, chomping on the grass, you know. A couple of fancy words. Zoanthropy is a mental disease where a person thinks that they're an animal. Boanthropy is where a person thinks they're a cow. You know, it says it will be for 7 times. Now, it's pretty vague. Could be for 7 seconds. Could be for 7 minutes. Could be for 7 days. Could be for 7 months. But for hair to grow out like he's describing and the nails to grow out like he's describing, most books I came across said they're pretty sure that it was 7 years that he's a cow. Now, I wonder if this preservation of his kingdom might not have happened because Daniel watched over him. Theory, maybe. Daniel knew about it from the beginning before it would happen. And so, verse 34, and at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored Him who lives forever. For His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and His kingdom is from generation to generation. Just like Jonah being swallowed in the belly of the whale. 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale. Why 3 days and three nights? Because that's how long it took him till he broke and said, okay, I give up, God. I'll do what you want. Because it took 3 days. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's a little more stubborn. It takes him 7 years. Or something, 7 months. Who knows? It takes him a long time, though, before he breaks. And finally, it says he lifts his eyes and his understanding returns. I think that's kind of interesting, the order there. Because there is a principle in Scripture that smartness, wisdom, intelligence is connected to who you worship. Romans chapter 1 says that when men worship the creature rather than the Creator, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And so here, this is the reverse happens with Nebuchadnezzar. He lifts his eyes and says, oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. What have I done? You are God. And then his understanding returned. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. Verse 35. He does according to his will in the army of heaven. And among the inhabitants of the earth, no one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? At the same time, my reason returned to me. And for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored in my kingdom. An excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice. And those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. I think that we will see Nebuchadnezzar in heaven. I think the things that are described in this chapter are descriptive of a man who has become born again, a man who's been changed, a man who understands who his God is, and it's the God of heaven. Now, I think the big principle, the big lesson in this chapter, I think, is humility, is learning humility. And even after Nebuchadnezzar's been warned, apparently he must have worked on it a little bit. It took a year. And finally, at the end of the year, he's like, oh, I'm God's against and I am so wonderful. You know, and finally he breaks out and declares him, and that's it. That's it. I do believe, gang, that humility needs to be cultivated and continued. I don't think you ever arrive at humility. I think humility is something that we have to work at. Because you put it down and pride will grow. I think that's the way it works. I think it's like a garden. You know, you don't have to do anything to make the weeds grow, do you? I mean, they just come all by themselves. Uninvited. Just boom, there's the weeds. You know, all you have to do is let it go and the weeds come. You tend to the garden, you take care of the weeds as they pop up. But if you let it go, and we've got this garden out back behind the building. Don't go look at it because it's really horrible. It's been a while. We've let it go.
and there are some huge weeds out there again. There, remember that Saturday we all cut them down? But that was what, a year ago almost, or whatever, 6 months ago. And they're back. They're back. Gang,
that's the way it is with pride and humility, is that if we don't stay on top of it, it will come back. What do we do to cultivate humility? Let me ask you, what do we do to cultivate humility? Do we just look in the mirror and say, trash, trash, you're bad, you're terrible? Is that what we do? What do we do to cultivate humility? You answer me. Come on. Follow the will of God.
Surrender pride.
Give credit to God. Help others. I think that's a big one. Philippians chapter 2 says, have this mind in you, which is the mind of Christ. Have this mind in you, who, though he existed in the form of God, did not regard it. There's what's called the great kenosis. He did not feel like he could hold on to it, but he emptied himself, it says. He poured himself out and took on the form of man, and even to the point of being a bondservant. Here's the King of Kings. Nebuchadnezzar was called King of Kings by Daniel, wasn't he? But Jesus is the true King of Kings. And what did he do? He became a servant even to the point of death. On the last night before he was betrayed, what's he doing? The King of Kings. He's washing the feet of his disciples. Right to the end. I think serving one another is a great way to cultivate humility. And I found another one. Look at 1 Peter 5. This is where we'll end tonight. Look at 1 Peter 5, verse 5. I thought it was kind of cool because while we were praying, Bob, you actually quoted this when we were praying tonight. I'm not lifting you up, buddy. I'm not lifting you up there, okay? So don't get proud, okay? 1 Peter 5, verse 5. It says, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Now that's, what better example than Nebuchadnezzar? God resists the proud. It's like, buddy, I just can't take this anymore. And God resisted, made him a cow. Moo, you know. And one of the things he says here, you know, being submissive to one another, that takes humility, doesn't it? That we would submit to one another, to not necessarily always do what you want to do, what I want to do, but sometimes I need to do what you want me. To be submissive to one another. But keep reading on. This is what I thought was kind of neat. Verse 6. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. That's all part of the same sentence. Part of the same sentence about talking about humility, about walking in humility is learning to cast your care on him. That's, now, what did you say, Dad? What did you, pride, putting away pride, surrender pride. Deb, what was yours? Giving him credit or something like that. But see, the thing with prayer is that when I stop thinking that I need him, when I stop thinking that I can get by with this, I don't need God. Well, I think maybe there's pride creeping up. Because the truth is, I do need him. And if I'm not casting my cares on him, if I'm not coming to him and pouring out my heart to him, well, then maybe I've got some lessons in humility to do. Because you know what, gang? Humble yourselves. Ask him for help. That's a part of cultivating. I think maybe that's a part of cultivating humility, is learning to pray about everything. Casting all my cares on him. Why? Because he is a great God.
and he has what I need. Yeah. Let's stand and pray.